morning, Valley Forge, King of Prussia and the greater Philadelphia area. This is We the People, the Constitution Matters, and we're coming to you over the Freedom Airways of WFYL. I'm your host, Pastor David Whitney. I serve as the senior instructor at Institute on the Constitution, and with me on this fine Friday morning is my wonderful collaborator, Phil Duffy, a constitutional instructor, and we have been walking through a history of government, now, all the way back to the Garden of Eden and the whole necessity of government at the very beginning. But we have been looking at both the sacred record, what the Bible tells us about civil government, and then we've also been looking, as Phil has taken us through, the ancient governments of ancient history, as well as all the way up until very recent, what we looked at last week, the Glorious Revolution in England, that is less than 100 years before the founding of our country. And then Phil is going to take us into that founding this morning. So it's important to understand the history of government, because if you look at what has happened most often in the history, you find that the powerful and those who are willing to abuse the God-given rights of other people are often those that rise to power. Kind of the old saying, scum rises to the top. And that seems to be often the case. The history of human civil government illustrates that. Some of the most evil, wicked, and tyrannical people are the ones that wind up ruling over other people because they're willing to do things that are corrupt, criminal, evil, godless, and so on. And if they accumulate enough power to themselves, they can often get away with those abuses for some period of time before the people push back and say, okay, enough is enough. We're tired of this corruption, and we're not going to take it any longer. But often it's quite a while of that kind of tyranny taking place before the people finally reach that breaking point where they say, no more, we're not going to have it. And that is exactly what the colonists in the 13 colonies of Great Britain came to the conclusion in 1774, five, and especially in 1776 when they declared independence. But I've been looking at the sacred record, what the biblical history tells us about government, and we have looked at the best form of human civil government, the one given by God to the children of Israel at Mount Sinai, and it was called the Hebrew Republic. And the design of this government was highly decentralized, as we looked at last week and the week before. Most governing was done at the very local level, the walled city being the center of the local government. And then the next level, of course, would be the tribal government and the national government of the whole of Israel. The only reason they ever came together was to go to war. Actually, not even to start the war, but to defend the territory of Israel and the tribes of Israel from invading armies. So really, the only function of that highest level of government, what we might call a national government, was to protect the borders. And indeed, that is a God-ordained job that human civil government has, to protect the borders, which makes you scratch your head with what's happening here in these United States. Like, wait a minute, if the government's job is to protect the borders, why aren't they protecting the borders? And in fact, that's what the law requires them to protect, the borders. Our Constitution requires that. Everything. Yeah, okay, we got a corrupt criminal class running the show, and they're doing the opposite of what their constitutional and even what their God-given duty is as a civil government. But we looked at the history of what was established there at Mount Sinai in terms of a highly decentralized government, a government very much in the hands of the people, a government very much run by volunteers. There was no heavy taxation because, hey, the judge and the jury, they were volunteers. The militia of the several tribes, when a war was pushed upon them, well, hey, they were not being paid except if they won the battle, and, you know, then they got to take booty. But there was no standing army that needed to be equipped and paid for and so on. No, none of that existed. So a very inexpensive government. But one of the stipulations that God showed the children of Israel at Mount Sinai was that this form of government he was giving to them, the Hebrew Republic, was dependent upon them obeying God's law, that self-government was the foundation. So the self-government that said, thou shalt not steal, and the people choose to obey God's law and not steal from their neighbor. The self-government that God's law says, thou shalt not murder. And the self-government to keep your hands off your neighbor's throat, don't murder your neighbor. And the self-government, thou shalt not commit adultery. The self-government, thou shalt not bear false witness, and thou shalt not covet. And all of those aspects, if the people were obedient to the law of God, that is, they were self-governed, the government, the civil government, could be very small. not much required. You didn't have to have a police force because, well, if nobody's stealing, murdering, committing adultery, and so on, the police really are unimportant. Only when a crime is committed is those powers required. And again, those powers were, again, in the hands of a voluntary type of function that there was no paid police force. But the caveat of all of that is this government would only work if the people were moral. That is, the people voluntarily obeyed the law of God. In fact, our founders said the same thing about our Constitution. Second President John Adams said our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious, by which he meant Christian people, a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate for the governance of any other. In other words, our Constitution won't work with the people who are not following Jesus in whatever denomination they choose, or if the people are not moral. So if the people choose to rebel against God's law and throw God's law out and tear 10 commandments down and those sorts of things and murder 65 million babies and all those other things, evil things being done, promoting sodomy and so on, if that's what the people do, this system of government will not work. And it was the same in the Hebrew Republic. And so when we read through the Bible of Joshua's the conquest, so the law was given on Mount Sinai, and then they entered the promised land under Joshua, and the conquest was accomplished, and the land was distributed, divided up among each of the tribes, and each of the tribes then divided up for each of the families that each had a family farm and so on. And the people were blessed when they obeyed God's law, when they worshiped the one true God and didn't turn aside to all the pagan idols around them, the Ashtaroths and the Baals and all the other pagan idolatry. When the people obeyed God's law in all of its aspects, they were blessed. They had liberty. They had their property protected. They had a good society where you didn't have to put a lock on your door because nobody stole. I remember an experience I had. I taught the U.S. Constitution course for Institute on the Constitution back in the hills, the foothills of the Allegheny Mountains there in western North Carolina. And it's a beautiful setting and wonderful people there. And the people there, because most of the people hold to a biblical standard of morality, whether they're Christians or not, they believe thou shalt not steal and so on. And so people would lock their cars and other things like that. And they'd have no problem. People would not steal their car just because the door was unlocked. Where neighborhood I live in, I hear repeatedly that in the middle of the night, you know, people with their door cams, they see somebody coming by to check to see if the doors of their car are locked or not. Because if they're not locked, they're going to get robbed. They're going to have somebody enter their car and steal whatever contents are left. So you have to lock your doors because in our community, people do not believe the Ten Commandments. They do not voluntarily obey the commandment, thou shalt not steal. So in this teaching that I was doing there, I had a great, great weekend. And somebody was offering to sell me something that I could not take with me as I returned home because I was going to be flying back and so on. So we made an arrangement because a friend of theirs was traveling up to Baltimore and was going to basically deliver the item that I was purchasing. And again, they were from this area where people did not lock their cars. Well, they had no idea that in Baltimore, you never, ever do that. If you don't lock your car, whatever's of value in your car is going to be stolen. And so guess what happened? Within an hour of them coming to Baltimore and parking their car, not locking the door, the item was stolen. Because the people in Baltimore do not believe God's law that says, thou shalt not steal. They are not self-governed, and therefore you need a lot of police and jail cells and all these other things to make it work. And so God warns his people in the Hebrew Republic, if you don't obey my law, there's consequences. And part of those consequences is you're going to lose your liberty. You may lose your property. You may even lose your life because that kind of criminal behavior, if it goes unchecked and if it is encouraged, is going to lead to more criminality. And that's exactly what we read in the book of Judges, that after they settled in the promised land, the people did not obey God's law individually, did not obey God's law corporately, and the result was disasters after disasters, wars and invasions and theft, and it was a disaster. And for a while, God would raise up a judge, and the judge would bring the people back to obeying God's law, and there'd be a window of time in which there was peace and security, but then they would go back to their old wicked ways, and the same cycle was repeated again and again throughout the book of Judges, such that at the end of that time period, the final judge for Israel under the Hebrew Republic was this man named Samuel. And Samuel, as he grew old and his sons were going to take his place, The people were unhappy with his sons. They felt like, oh, these guys are corrupt. They're not to be trusted. We trusted Samuel. We don't trust these guys. And so they said to Samuel, we're tired of this republic system. It doesn't work. We're not experiencing safety and security. And the reason weren't is because of their own disobedience. It would have worked had they been obedient to God's law. And so they said, we want you to give us a king. We want a monarchy because this republic no longer works. And Samuel went before God, and God said, okay, it's not my ideal. It's not what I planned. But if they want a monarch, they can choose to have a monarch because God believes in consent of the governed. These people want that system of government. But he told Samuel, before you introduce the new king, which is going to be King Saul, you need to tell them the nature of this new government you are choosing. And this new government is going to be extremely different than the old, because the old was very inexpensive. It was largely volunteer. Your taxes were extremely small compared to what this new king would do. And he says this in 1 Samuel chapter 8, if you'd like to read over this yourself, and it is indeed worthwhile reading. He says, verse 11, this 1 Samuel 8:11, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. In other words, your family business and the most essential employees in your family business are your sons. And the king is going to take your sons out of your family business. So in other words, you're going to have to go hire employees and pay them more than you were paying your sons, who were part of the business, part of the blessing of the family business. But you're going to have to hire other employees because the king is going to conscript your sons into his army. And the idea of that some will run before his chariot. Hey, this king is going to demand that he have a secret service brigade, people who are going to protect him. And where's the money going to come from? Not only is he going to take your sons out of your family business, and now you got to go hire employees to replace them. When the king hires these men to be his soldiers and to be his security guards, who's going to pay them? The king doesn't have any money of his own. A civil government never has any money of its own. And even if it did, if the king was wealthy, he wouldn't take the money out of his own coffers to pay for his security services and to pay for his military. No, no. He's going to tax you in order to pay for all this extra protection that his monarchical government is going to have. And then he goes on to say in verse 12, he, the king, will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, and will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. So not only is he going to take his sons into the military, he's going to use his sons to plant and harvest his crop, to feed his courtiers, those who are coming into court. He's going to give them a lavish banquet. Where's that food going to come from? Again, it's going to come from the work that your sons are going to do in his employ. They're no longer working for your business. They're working for him. And then he's going to develop a military industrial complex, you know, making his weapons of war. Again, who's going to pay for all this? It's going to be the taxpayers. The king's money is not going to pay to develop military weapons. No, no, no. It's going to be out of your pockets. And verse 13 says, it won't be just your sons he goes after. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. So he'll take your daughters to be employed again in, oh, you know, he's got to have a fancy kitchen and all kinds of elaborate foodstuffs to feed the courtiers who come to his banqueting table and all those sort of things. And he's going to, again, deprive you. He's deprived you of your sons already in your family business, so you had to hire employees. Now he's going to deprive you of your daughters, and you got to hire more employees for your family business because he's taking all your children to work for him when they were working for your family business, whether it was the family farm or the blacksmith shop or whatever your family business might have been. Not only that, verse 14 says he's going to practice what in our day we call eminent domain. That's right, where the government says, we need your property. You know, we've got some better use of your property than you do, and he's going to take the best of your fields, the best of your vineyards and your olive groves, and he's going to give them to his servants. So not only is he going to take them from you, he's not necessarily just going to use them to build a road. He's going to give them as a gift to his favored courtiers in his retinue of those who surround him as king. So he's going to profit the people that he pleases, the people that are his servants. And he's going to do so, but not out of his own resources. He's going to steal your resources. He's going to steal your property to do this. And not only that, he's going to tax you. Verse 15, he will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. So he's going to tax you to pay all the government employees that he has now, as this huge monarchical government is being formed, in contrast to the Hebrew Republic, where most of the supposed functions of government were done voluntarily, without pay, with no great infrastructure. Now we have a highly centralized government, a very expensive government, and he's going to tax you. Notice it says 10% there. Oh, would to God we enjoyed a 10% taxation from our federal, state, and local governments. We're in the midst of tax season right now. As you know, April 15th is approaching at a little less than a month away, and people are feverishly going through all the crazy requirements, the IRS, and all the garbage you got to read of your state forms and federal forms, and now the mess. Well, our government takes a lot more than 10%, as every one of us knows, and even worse than 10%, they take an invisible amount based upon inflation where they're stealing from us. Then verse 16 says, he will take your male servants and your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys, and put them to his work. So he's not only going to take your sons and daughters. When you hire employees, he may decide he wants them too. So you're going to have to find other employees, which means what happens to the price of labor? It increases, because you got all these government employees and you got competition in the labor market, and there's fewer people that can work the family business because the government is hiring all these people. And of course, the pay for those people working for the government comes out of your pocket. And he says here, 17, and he will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants, and you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we will have a king to rule over us, that we might be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us to fight our battles. So here's the picture, and God gives it very clearly to the children of Israel. You know, you've got a choice here. You could have a republic, very small government that doesn't take a whole lot, but does require you to be voluntarily involved in the militia, voluntarily involved in the court system as a juror or functioning as a judge without pay. Those are things that are going to be a sacrifice on your part. But the result will be, if you're obedient to the law of God as a community, you're going to experience tremendous blessing, tremendous liberty. And by the way, you also experience tremendous prosperity. And that is very true, not only for the Hebrew Republic, but it was true for our country. As the American Republic, we experienced tremendous liberty. Liberty that people who came here, they were like Alexis de Tocqueville in the 1830s, they were astonished at the degree of freedom and the smallness of the government. He asked people, where's your government? Ah, it's off distant. It really has no interaction with us on a daily basis. You know, it doesn't coerce us or control us. And we have freedom. And also tremendous prosperity, which is why so many people flooded to the shores of these United States. We had tremendous immigration because people saw that here they weren't going to be taxed to death, taxed enough already. They were experiencing that in Europe. They were having their land confiscated and all the other things, but they came to America, and this is a land of freedom. This is a land of opportunity. They could actually own land. They could have blessing of freedom, and we grew in great prosperity, perhaps the most prosperous nation on earth through the 19th and into the 20th century. And all of those blessings were because the Republic, the American Republic, was designed, as our founder said, to follow the laws of nature, nature's God. The laws that say, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not bear false witness and murder, and all the commands of God. When we followed those as a nation, when that was true of the character of our country, we experienced blessing and prosperity beyond compare. But since we have left off of that, and since we have left off of actually worshiping the one true God, and prayer was pulled out of the public schools, and the Ten Commandments were torn down off the wall, and you weren't permitted to read the Bible in the schools, and the destruction of our republic began as a rejection of God and a rejection of his law as the supreme law of the land. And so we've experienced some of what is described here, even worse than what was described here in 1 Samuel chapter 8, of the curses of a big, greedy government. And what we see at both federal, state, and local is a very greedy government. They're never satisfied, no matter how much blood they squeeze out of us in taxation, in fees, in regulation control. They are never satisfied. It's an insatiable monster that our government has become at federal, state, and local levels, and they want more and more and more of us, our blood, our treasure. our sweat and labor, and we can only, I believe, restore the Republic by returning to those biblical principles of obeying God's laws. Our founders called them the laws of nature, nature's God, by which they were referring to the law of God given to us in the Word of God, that there are fixed moral values. We need to inculcate those values in the young, not to train them to be sodomites and transgenders as the public school does today, but rather train them to be godly young men and women who obey the law of God. But we've been told that's impermissible. The First Amendment doesn't allow that. That's hogwash. Because the First Amendment, if you read it carefully, the very first word, Congress shall not. Congress. It's a restriction only on Congress, not on the local school board, not on the state government, not on the county government. It's a restriction on Congress shall not do this set of things. And this was why the First Amendment had no impact on reading the Bible in public schools and praying in public schools and singing hymns in public schools and teaching the Christian faith in those schools. And that's why America was strong and America is great. And to restore our republic is going to require more than just a cursory understanding of the text of the Constitution. It's going to mean restoring the moral foundation of law and government in our land, which is the Christian faith. Well, Phil, why don't you bring us your thoughts about the founding of these United States?
Well, having explored civil government from Sumeria to the Glorious Revolution, we should understand some basic ideas. And the first is, the overwhelmingly dominant form of government over history has been monarchy. Theoretically, this is government by one individual over others, but all monarchs have been compelled to create courts of supporters and a landed aristocracy to geographically extend the monarch's control. Both have also been the source of overthrow of monarchs. In the West, pure monarchy effectively died at the conclusion of World War I. Second idea is that oligarchy became an alternative to monarchy in ancient Athens during its Golden Age and in the Roman Republic. The rise of the Italian republics in the Renaissance was associated with the increasing importance of commerce and a commercial class. Nonetheless, the functions of government remain centralized, although control of those functions was shared by an elite. The third idea is the old Swiss Confederation and the Dutch Republic were the two exceptions to centralized government power, in that the member states retained their sovereignty except for specific functions for which the Confederacy was formed. The Dutch Republic evolved into a constitutional monarchy, leaving only one enduring example of a successful confederation, the old Swiss Confederation. As a model for the United States, it was deficient because of its size. Switzerland today is the combined size of Vermont and New Hampshire. And the fourth idea is the Glorious Revolution in Britain resulted in a constitutional monarchy, which placed a constitutional shield between the natural rapacious tendencies of centralized government and the rights of the people. In the case of Britain, this constitution is unwritten. Constitutional monarchies are more sensitive to the rights of the people, but do little to decentralize government. And the last idea is, the founding of the United States was an attempt to substitute a written constitution for an unwritten constitution. It was also an attempt to decentralize government along the lines of the old Swiss Confederation, but on a potentially continental scale. Let's look a little more closely at the United States founding. Most of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention had a sense for the history of civil government, but one stood out, James Madison. Unlike 39 of the Constitution signers, Madison was not a lawyer. His specialty was political history. No doubt the other delegates listened to Madison when the history of civil government was discussed. Both Madison and Alexander Hamilton represented their respective states, Virginia and New York, at the prior Annapolis Convention. According to Maryland State Archives, the Annapolis Convention was a meeting of 12 delegates from 5 states, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Virginia, that called for a constitutional convention. The formal title of the meeting was a meeting of commissioners to remedy defects of the federal government. The defects that they were to remedy were those barriers that limited trade or commerce between the states under the Articles of Confederation. Much has been made of the so-called defects of the federal government under the Articles of Confederation. The barriers to commerce were real that were explored at the Annapolis Convention. However, addressing those defects did not require the establishment of the national government that arose out of the Constitutional Convention that followed the Annapolis Convention. Each of the original states in the United States had the benefit of a common language and similar cultures, advantages not shared by European governments. And yet those European nations, former enemies, began to put together a free trade zone as a result of the Treaty of Rome in 1957. There is agreement that the Articles of Confederation needed to be substantially modified, but articles on this subject on the internet are suspiciously long on opinion and short on logic. For example, one of the most often cited limitations of the articles is that the federal government could only request funds of the states. That conflicts with the wording in the Articles of Confederation. Article 8, all charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare and allowed by the United States and Congress assembled shall be defrayed out of the common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the value of all land within each state, granted to or surveyed for any person, as such land and the buildings and improvements thereon shall be estimated, according to such mode as the United States and Congress assembled shall from time to time direct and appoint. The taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states within the time agreed upon the United States in Congress assembled. Again, suspiciously, it is difficult to find which states did not comply with Article 8. That is important because the states had agreed to the provisions of Article 8. This was a matter of individual states not meeting contract obligations. What actions were taken to encourage the delinquent states to meet their obligation? The internet seems silent. The government under the articles need not send an army to require the delinquent states to comply. Non-compliance is a basis for nullifying a contract, and the delinquent states should have faced the consequences of having disqualified themselves from participation in the Confederation. The call for a constitutional convention demonstrated that the other states were willing to take action against the delinquent states. Even the agreement to conduct constitutional convention proceedings in secret was reasonable. Given the nature of the discussions, it would have been difficult to conduct those in public. The delegates had two attractive alternatives available to them. The first, to make changes under the structure of the existing Articles of Confederation, or two, combine the best ideas of the articles with the required changes in a new constitution. They elected the second alternative and even incorporated some of the strengths of the Articles of Confederation in the proposed constitution. In order to make the federated government stronger, however, they created a monster that was ultimately able to intimidate state governments. Instead of placing sanctions on the states for not remitting their funding allocations, they granted the federal government unlimited taxing power. But doesn't the original Constitution prohibit direct taxation of individuals? This is what Article 1, Section 8 says. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution seems to limit the federal government's taxation power on the individual. No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Article 1, Section 9 does not limit the amount of tax that can be seized from the individual. It only requires that everybody be taxed the same amount. The 16th Amendment removes that restriction. Now the federal government may tax citizens arbitrarily. Not satisfied with that awesome power, the federal government passed the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which established a monopolistic central bank capable of issuing counterfeit currency. If there were practical limits to the citizens' wealth that could be seized by the federal government, those limits could be bypassed as the federal government satisfied its voracious appetite for its citizens' wealth through inflation. Before considering some of the other reasons for abandoning the Articles of Confederation, let's consider how federations are supposed to work. They're based upon member states retaining most sovereign powers while outsourcing limited powers to a superentity they form strictly for that purpose. A federation is not a national government. The Constitution creating the federation should put strict limits on the powers of the superentity, and states should retain a board of directors' power over the newly created superentity. Anti-federalists were not satisfied the original Constitution adequately protected individual liberties. They forced a compromise that led to the Bill of Rights being appended to the Constitution. That's the first 10 amendments. Although initially opposed to the idea of a Bill of Rights, Madison immediately took on the challenge when the first Congress was convened. At this point, Madison reversed his initial stand against including a Bill of Rights into the basic Constitution, as reported by History.com. Madison, tasked with writing the new amendments, addressed some of his concerns by including the Ninth Amendment, that states' rights are not limited to those listed in the Constitution, and the Tenth Amendment, which limits the federal government's powers to those granted specifically in the Constitution and its amendments. The second concern was never resolved. As long as the Articles of Confederation government existed, there was effective oversight of the federal government's operations. But mysteriously, the Confederation Congress quickly agreed to its own extinction by passing the Constitution to the states for ratification without amendment. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention had been charged to amend the Articles of Confederation, not to replace the Articles. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention had violated their mission statement. With wide opposition to a national government, why had the government of the Articles of Confederation been abandoned? The limitations of that government, as previously mentioned, are only a partial explanation and could have been addressed as amendments to the Articles. In addition, however, there appears to have been a political campaign to picture the government under the Articles of Confederation as weak and inept. That picture conflicts with the facts. The Confederation government had successfully concluded a war of independence against Britain, then the most powerful military power in the world. It had successfully negotiated the Peace of Paris, extending the United States from 13 colonies hugging the shores of the Atlantic Ocean to a federation that included land to the Mississippi River. It had established a model for new states to be accepted into the Confederation with the Northwest Ordinance. All of this had come at a significant cost. The British had attempted to leave its former colonies barefoot and pregnant. There were no mints and little opportunity to create a currency beyond a based upon a precious metal. Most international trade was based upon credit, and what hard currency circulated was the British pound and the Spanish dollar. The newly expanded United States were rich in natural resources, and the Confederation government, for practical purposes, owned the land between the Allegheny Mountains and the Mississippi River that could be sold to raise funds. Contrary to the propaganda circulated by so-called Federalists who really wished for a national government, the United States were not in danger of being cut off from credit by the rest of the world. The Department of State's Office of the Historian offers this explanation of the situation when the Constitution was being considered for ratification. During the Revolution, the French government also provided the Americans with loans, eventually totaling over $2 million, most of which were negotiated by Benjamin Franklin. John Adams also secured a loan from Dutch bankers in 1782. After fighting between the Americans and the British ended in 1783, the new U.S. government established under the Articles of Confederation needed to pay off its debts, but lacked sufficient tax authority to secure any revenue. The government struggled to pay off the loans, stopping payments of interest to France in 1785 and defaulting on further installments that were due in 1787. The United States also owed money to the Spanish government and private Dutch investors, but focused on paying off the Dutch because Amsterdam remained the most likely source of future loans, which the United States successfully obtained in 1787 and 1788, despite its precarious financial state. Under the U.S. Constitution of 1789, the new federal government enjoyed increased authority to manage U.S. finances and to raise revenues through taxation. Responsibility for managing debts fell to Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton placed U.S. finances on firmer ground, allowing for the U.S. government to negotiate new loans at lower interest rates. We should be suspicious when this account indicates the Dutch offered additional credit in the same year of the Constitution was being considered. We should also be suspicious about the claim that the government under the Constitution was able to resolve the credit crisis as a result of new taxing powers and the financial genius of that Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton did not find a new source of wealth to tax. And the government of the Constitution, created was larger and more expensive than its predecessor. And why would states refuse to pay their federal allocation under the Articles of Confederation and then vote to give a new federal government unlimited taxing power under the Constitution? That doesn't make sense. Perhaps the most preposterous justification for the Constitution was the fear that the states could not contain rebellion and required a larger federal police force to overcome that deficiency. Shays' rebellion was the example, but it was put down by Governor Bowdoin of Massachusetts, who created an army under Continental General Benjamin Lincoln. The operation was funded by commercial interests in Boston, who stood to benefit from the foreclosure of Western Massachusetts farms owned by war veterans who had not been paid for their service. The rebels had been dispersed in late January 1787, well before the Constitutional Convention was convened. The voters of Massachusetts perceived the injustice, and subsequently threw Bowdoin out of office and in the election of April 1787, before the Constitutional Convention assembled. Let's look at the refusal to pay federal funds allotment. Of all of the justifications for replacing the Articles of Confederation with the Constitution, the myth prevails that Congress, under the Articles, could only request that states submit funds that had been requisitioned by Congress. We have seen that was not true. Samuel Ellett Morrison described the situation in the Oxford History of the American People. Only New Jersey refused absolutely to pay the annual requisition, but other states did so, in fact, by applying their shares to pay interest on federal debts owed to their own citizens. Curiously, New Jersey was the third state to ratify the Constitution, and it did that 15 days before Massachusetts ratified conditionally, based upon the promise that Congress would immediately take action to include a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. Why would New Jersey vote to give the federal government unlimited taxing power under the Constitution when it previously refused to pay its share of the federal debt under the Articles of Confederation? Hamilton was a close friend of the Livingstons in New Jersey, having lived with the Livingstons when he attended Francis Barber's Grammar School in Elizabethtown. William Livingston was the first governor of New Jersey. New Jersey was Hamilton turf. It wasn't unreasonable that the requisition funds be used to resolve federal debts owed to a state's own citizens. In this case, the repayment was limited to interest and not principal. An alternative was available, a temporary grant of taxing power to the federal government under the Articles until debts had been resolved. It is difficult to find any serious discussion of that alternative, particularly when the alternative that ultimately won condemned states to perpetual unlimited taxation by the federal government under the Constitution. Let's look at Hamilton's reports to the first Congress. In the initial days of the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton proposed that the new government would acquire energy through the creation of a precedent for life. His ideas were rejected, so he left the convention in a huff, but later returned to a new plan to establish a national government under a strong executive. He proposed to sell the Constitution to the states using the Federalist Essays. He recruited fellow nationalist John Jay of New York, but realized that the two authors alone would project too much of a national government image, so he recruited James Madison, a Virginian. the two major authors of the Federalists worked well together, but moved in opposite directions when Hamilton submitted his three reports to Congress expanding the role of the federal government along mercantilist lines. In order to implement that program, Hamilton invented the concept of implied powers in the Constitution. At first, Washington seemed unsure of the concept, and he requested an opinion of the Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, and his Attorney General, Edmund Randolph. Both stated unequivocally that there were no implied powers in the Constitution. But Washington ultimately listened to Hamilton, who had served under him in the War of Independence. Thus, the die was cast. A federal government had been created with unlimited taxing powers. In 1913, it would augment these with unlimited powers to inflate the currency. While the Constitution did not authorize the vast majority of expenditures over the life of the government under the Constitution, every expenditure could be rationalized under the implied powers and general welfare interpretations of the Constitution. The foundation for crony capitalism had been set in place by Alexander Hamilton.
Oh, excellent, Phil. Thank you so much, because we see there the exact move from a republic, very limited form of government with highly decentralized, towards a monarchy. And it's fascinating if you have ever had a chance to look at Hamilton's proposal that he presented to the Constitutional Convention, which they rejected. Everybody rejected. Nobody was interested in the monarchical kind of government that Hamilton was proposing. And like you said, he left in a huff. But when you look at that, he was a monarchist and wanted kind of a monarchical position for the president to have these powers of a king, and definitely the power of unlimited taxation and unlimited power to spend. And as you mentioned, something that couldn't even been conceived, I think, by our founders, the idea is of granting the federal government this unlimited power to inflate the currency, which may be the worst form of taxation because it's so hidden and it's impossible to see it clearly, other than you know that, well, you go to the grocery store today and what used to, fill a grocery cart with groceries, today you're not getting even close to half of that as inflation is eating away very rapidly at the purchasing power of our dollar.
Well, yeah, I'd like to add one thought here. This series has focused, and I think appropriately, to the history before the founding of the United States. Under the Constitution. But there is subsequent history that brings us to today. It's been excluded because the history is a result of the form of government that was selected at the founding. In other words, the systemic limitations that were embedded in the nation's founding of the Constitution actually, if we look at ideas like the general welfare and the implied powers, they basically open up the door. I mean, the dam is burst. Anything can be rationalized, including a medical care. There's nothing in the Constitution of the United States that indicates the federal government has anything to do whatsoever with health care. But if you talk to the people in the state of Pennsylvania who were promoting this at that time, they were consistent. They constantly would tell you about the general welfare and the fact that the federal government had the ability, the power, if you will, to tax. And therefore, it was all constitutional. That is, hello.
Yeah. And we know that
what are you thinking, guys?
They were distorting what our founders clearly stated. You're right to say that Jefferson and Edmund Randolph said, no way, there are no implied powers. It only means what it says, because if you don't take the text of the Constitution to mean only what it says, what you've created is a government that can do whatever it pleases. You've created a tyranny over yourself, and you've allowed that tyranny to expand. Now, one of the things that we see in the history of the country is that tyranny really didn't catch hold until about the middle of the 19th century, that war between the states. Wars always expand government powers, and they certainly did in that terrible and unnecessary war. But what we see in the trend is that people over time began to expect more and more and more from government. So by the time we get to FDR, during the Great Depression, many, many people were, you know, they didn't realize that what had been done in 1913 had set the grounds for a terrible, destructive Great Depression. Yes, we'd had downturns in the economy, we'd had panics and all, but there was always a quick recovery. But putting the Federal Reserve in charge and in control meant that the greatest depression was the depression that happened after the Federal Reserve was created, which they, you know, sold the Federal Reserve as, oh, we got to do this to prevent those panics from happening. No, the worst panic happened after the Federal Reserve. So instead of helping the problem, they worsened the problem, but it also set up the scenario where many, many people in America were willing to have a more monarchical type of government, you know, going back to 1 Samuel 8, a government that taxed them heavily, a government that hired a whole raft of government employees, and, you know, government that was involved in things like the military-industrial complex, all these things. The people wanted that. Not all the people, but a significant percentage of the people wanted a bigger and bigger government because they wanted the government to become their nanny, you know, the government to provide for them in their old age rather than the biblical standard. It's not Social Security, it's children's security. You know, the biblical standard is when you grow old, your children, your family, they're the ones who are supposed to be taking care of you. You took care of them and changed their diapers. Well, they may need to change yours, or they may need to pay to take care of your needs in your old age. Your children were your best security in God's design, rather than the government replacing your family with Social Security. All these programs came about and had been tolerated by the American people because many people wanted them. If the people rose up and said, we're finished, we don't want, you know, go through the laundry list. We don't want OSHA. We don't want EPA. We don't want Social Security. We don't want Medicare. We don't, you know, just go through the list of things. And if the people said, we don't want that because we recognize those things are tyrannical and those things restrict our freedom, we would prefer to have our freedom and struggle as we might with difficulties in life. We'd rather deal with those difficulties ourselves rather than hand them off to a tyrannical government that becomes the nanny state that's supposed to take care of us all from cradle to grave.
You know, the war between the states is really a pretty good subject to explore, to really find out what had happened here in terms of the transitioning from the Articles of Confederation through the Constitution, through the implied powers addition to the Constitution, which turned it into an entirely different thing. Basically, if you look at the concept of a union, it was very important. Consider that Lincoln did not get involved in the war between the states to free the slaves. I mean, that happened in 1863, and I think he acknowledged that it was a military strategy that he had used, but basically, the concern was taxes. There was the World Tariff, which was one of the worst tariffs that really it impacted the South very, very badly. South Carolina said, hell no, I won't go. And then the whole thing was set up so that the supposedly South Carolinians fired the first shot on the American flag. Well, what union were we talking about? The union was disbanded because it was established under the Articles of Confederation. I believe there are five or six references in it that says that the government was a perpetual union. Now, that's a little bit of nonsense to begin with, because there is no such thing as a perpetual union in history. I mean, it just hasn't, if you look back over history, and nothing has been perpetual. But that was the agreement. And so that was disbanded. And then we get into this nonsense about the Constitution creating a more perfect union. Wait a second. I mean, I was taught in grammar school that there is no such thing as more perfect or most perfect. The superlative form of perfect is perfect. You can't get beyond that. You can say most nearly perfect. You know, and so you have this idiotic writing in the Constitution about a nearly, a more perfect union. No, sorry about that. The union was disbanded by the people who created the Constitution. I'd like to add something about the nanny state, if I can. I think that Hillsdale College has really gotten into this better than anybody else in their Constitution 101 course. And they talk about the administrative state and where those ideas came from. And basically, it was the fact that for social sciences in particular, there was no way that one could get a an advanced degree here in the United States. And so all of these PhD candidates went over to Bismarck's Germany. And Bismarck, of course, was well known for warfare, very effective for warfare, probably a little bit less well known for his adoption of welfareism. And he did it for very practical political reasons. He wanted to co-opt the socialist movement in Germany. And so he built the welfare state, Social Security, the long-term health program and all the rest of that. That comes straight out of Bismarck. So here are our candidates over there. They're gobbling up all of this nonsense from people like Hegel and his successors. They come back enamored with the warfare / welfare state of Prussia. That is what progressivism is. If you look at these people who came back, and it's a fascinating web of individuals with bizarre thinking, by the way, you realize that there was a cross-infection that occurred. You had this European disease that was brought back to the United States and sold as progressivism. It was not progressivism. It was regressivism. It was going back to the old system of Diocletian, if you will, in the Roman Empire. And it led to the disintegration of the Roman Empire. It didn't work.
So Bismarck, in order to avoid socialism, became a socialist, huh?
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Crazy. And the people who were moving us in that same socialist direction, they love the idea of big government that somehow, we're going to benefit. But really, socialism only works, as Margaret Thatcher famously said, until you run out of other people's money. That is, you've got to take from somebody who's a producer, because, again, people forget this, civil government produces nothing. It's like a leech. It's like a tick. It bleeds off a blood-producing animal, so you get enough ticks on your dog in the summertime, and that dog's going to die. It will only survive if it doesn't have all those ticks. So the government produces nothing, and socialism means they're taking from the people who produce to give to the people who don't produce, which is going to encourage more people not to produce. And ultimately, that's going to lead to a destruction of the whole system as everybody figures out, oh, I can get a freebie. It's like the millions coming across the borders of our country. I'm coming here for the freebies because I don't have to do nothing. They will rob the resources that other people have created, and they'll just put them in my pocket or put them on my plastic debit card for free without anything required of me. Well, to undo that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. There's absolutely no exploration of the idea, the cost of these programs. None whatsoever. And I think it was in 1936, there was an addition to that, an important addition, by Lord Keynes, the general theory of it and so forth. The idea that there were at times insufficient demand because of the limitation of the free market economy. Nonsense. People's desires are unlimited. There's never been a time in history in which there was insufficient demand, and yet nobody questioned that. And that created what became known just a few years ago as a modern monetary theory, the idea that since governments can print money, that they have absolutely no need for financial responsibility.
Well, to restore our republic, we need to understand these founding principles. And that's why we exist here. We the People, the Constitution Matters, coming to you with the Freedom Airwaves of WFYL. Join us next Friday morning, 8 a.m. Go to the website, 1180WFYL.com. Click on podcasts. We're at the very bottom. We the People, the Constitution Matters, because it does.